So this morning, as we come to Mark chapter 10, verses 32 to 52, Mark has, these previous chapters, been building a club sandwich of layered stacks that speak to us about the teaching and the examples and the encounters of Jesus. And today's no different. Since the Transfiguration on the Mount, Jesus has been leading his disciples towards Jerusalem. The expectations now are high. Jesus has confirmed his messianic identity. His disciples know what he thinks about himself. And all it seems remains is the showdown. The showdown followed by a great victory. At least this is in the disciples' mind. And before things in momentum gets going too fast, the disciples want to get some things kind of straightened out before they get kind of caught up in all of what it is that they expect is going to take place. They want to make sure that things are kind of properly in order and everything's said that needs to be said before that happens. But Jesus also wants them to be clear. In today's passage, Jesus is going to speak directly about his identity, his mission, his call. And we're going to find in it an example of both the sort of person whom he is calling, but also the sort of person who will experience its faithfulness and fruitfulness. And as we look at Mark 10, we're going to be looking at the identity of Jesus, the mission of Jesus, the call to discipleship, that is, the call to follow Jesus, and fourthly, the disciple who gets it. And Hayes Keener, if you would come forward. Hayes is going to read our passage for us this morning.
Our sermon text this morning is from the Gospel of Mark 10, 32 through 52. And they were on the road going up to Jerusalem, and Jesus was walking ahead of them. And they were amazed, and those who followed were afraid. And taking the 12 again, he began to tell them what was to happen to him, saying, "See, we are going up to Jerusalem, and the Son of Man will be delivered over to the chief priests and the scribes, and they will condemn him to death and deliver him over to the Gentiles. And they will mock him and spit on him and flog him and kill him. And after 3 days he will rise." And James and John, the sons of Zebedee, came up to him and said to him, "Teacher, we want you to do for us whatever we ask of you." And he said to them, "What do you want me to do for you?" And they said to him, "Grant us to sit, one at your right hand and one at your left, in your glory." Jesus said to them, "You do not know what you are asking. Are you able to drink the cup that I drink, or to be baptized with the baptism with which I am baptized?" And they said to him, "We are able." And Jesus said to them, "The cup that I drink, you will drink, and with the baptism with which I am baptized, you will be baptized. But to sit at my right hand or at my left is not mine to grant, but it is for those for whom it has been prepared." And when the 10 heard it, they began to be indignant at James and John. And Jesus called them to him and said to them, "You know that those who are considered rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and their great ones exercise authority over them. But it shall not be so among you. But whoever would be great among you must be your servant, and whoever would be first among you must be slave of all. For even the Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve, and to give his life as a ransom for many." And they came to Jericho, and as he was leaving Jericho with his disciples and a great crowd, Bartimaeus, a blind beggar, the son of Timaeus, was sitting by the roadside. And when he heard that it was Jesus of Nazareth, he began to cry out and say, "Jesus, Son of David, have mercy on me." And many rebuked him, telling him to be silent. But he cried out all the more, "Son of David, have mercy on me." And Jesus stopped and said, "Call him." And they called the blind man, saying to him, "Take heart, get up, he is calling you." And throwing off his cloak, he sprang up and came to Jesus. And Jesus said to him, "What do you want me to do for you?" And the blind man said to him, "Rabbi, let me recover my sight." And Jesus said to him, "Go your way. your faith has made you well. And immediately he recovered his sight and followed him on the way. This is the word of the Lord.
Thank you so much, Hayes. All right, let's firstly look at the identity of Jesus. Now, much of the identity of Jesus in Mark's gospel has been set before us already. Jesus is the one who has authority. He has authority in his teaching, over disease, over evil spirits, over the weather, over sin and its forgiveness, and over death itself. He's demonstrated all of that up to this point. And though he's worked to keep his identity secret in spite of demons seeking to identify him, Jesus has revealed that he is the Christ. We've read that. But in his disciples' mind, this messianic designation, right, that he is the Christ, that he is the Lord's anointed, is not a divine one. This is important for us to understand at this point in the disciples' understanding. Right? It's reasonable to assume that though he has power and authority, those around him are expecting an earthly king and kingdom, although it's going to be a magnificent one, apparently. Right? What's clear is that the tension is mounting and the people are on edge. Jesus is leading his disciples up to Jerusalem. We read that the disciples were astonished at those who were afraid. It's likely that Mark was one of those who were accompanying Jesus as he was heading up into from Jericho to Jerusalem. And this all speaks to this expectation that something big is about to happen. This confrontation is coming. And along with the expectation of what is coming, it's the sense of the disciples that it's time to stake out your position. When James and John approach Jesus to request seats on Jesus' right and left in your glory, they're putting themselves forward as, say, prime minister and chancellor of the government that they expect Jesus to establish. Or maybe as a military commander, which might not be inappropriate for two who had been nicknamed the Thunder Brothers. You remember that. We read that when the disciples discover what James and John have done, they're indignant. And they're not indignant because James and John are so foolish to not understand the nature of the kingdom of God. They're indignant because James and John got the upper hand on them and got to Jesus first. And thirdly, even in Jericho, Jesus' reputation has preceded him. This blind beggar calls him Son of David. Now, I don't know if the others rebuked him at that time because they thought so little of him and they didn't want him bothering Jesus, or because they knew how tension was mounting and they didn't want Jesus' identity to be exposed at this point. But Jesus wants to be clear. And as he begins to make his ascent from Jericho up to Jerusalem, he speaks to his mission. He's already spoken about this two times earlier. He's spoken of his betrayal, his death, and his resurrection. He's spoken plainly about these things to his disciples. But this one is the most direct and clear statement of what it is that he intends to do, what his mission is. We are going up to Jerusalem, he says, and the Son of Man will be betrayed to the chief priests and the teachers of the law, and they will condemn him to death and will hand him over to the Gentiles, who will mock him and spit on him, flog and kill him. 3 days later, he will rise. Now, the request of James and John bring out an ironic understanding of what right and left in his glory means. Being on Jesus' right and left as he ascends to the pinnacle of his messianic mission is not going to be a seated position, nor will it be a moment of high praise and honor. Their request does provide a clear statement of the nature of his mission. Jesus has come to fulfill something. And he asked James and John, Jesus says, can you drink the cup that I drink or be baptized with the baptism I am baptized with? Now, they're so foolish, right, that they respond, yes, yes, we can. But Jesus isn't speaking of the same categories of glory, right? To drink the cup and to be baptized is not a picture of exaltation and vindication. It is a picture of judgment. The drinking of the cup, right, was an image that the Lord used in speaking through his prophets to describe his judgment on the nations of Israel and Judah, right? You read this in the Old Testament. In one passage, Ezekiel, in Ezekiel 23, we read this. You have gone, Ezekiel is speaking to Judah as they are preparing to go into exile, right? The first captives have been taken to Babylon, and it happens in stages. But Ezekiel's writing back to Judah and to Jerusalem. He says, you have gone the way of your sister, that is Israel. Therefore, I will give her cup into your hand. Thus says the Lord God, you shall drink your sister's cup that is deep and large, and you shall be laughed at and held in derision, for it contains much. You will be filled with drunkenness and sorrow, a cup of horror and desolation. The cup of your sister Samaria, you shall drink it and drain it out and gnaw its shards and tear your breasts, for I have spoken, declares the Lord. Right, this picture of judgment that is coming. Unless we forget, right, baptism isn't some sweet rite that we perform for children or on children. It's not a sweet rite. It is actually a picture of the passing through the waters of judgment, right? And passing through those waters with Jesus. The miraculous inclusion into the life body of the people of God comes with great loss. In just the same way that the disciples or the apostles linked baptism with the flood and with the people of Israel passing through the Red Sea, right? There is great loss that is accompanied that with that. And though baptism is something that is bloodless, baptism isn't a sweet thing. It's a judgment thing. And it is a sign to you and to the world of what it is that Jesus has done for us once for all in dying in our place. The work that Jesus has finished is the work of paying the ransom for you. For even the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many. Right? That Jesus paid the ransom means that he has paid the full price of deliverance for those who are enslaved to sin and captive to condemnation. Timothy Keller puts it this way. He says, to give his life as a ransom for many sums up the reason why he has to die. Jesus came to be a substitute, a substitutionary sacrifice. Right? You consider the little preposition for in that sentence that we read from Mark, in the phrase, a ransom for many. It's the Greek word anti, which means instead of, or in place of, or substitute. What about a ransom? In English, we don't even use the word nowadays except to speak about the payment for somebody who maybe has been kidnapped. But here it translates the Greek word lutron, which means to buy the freedom of a slave or a prisoner. Right? The ransomer would make a huge sacrificial payment that matched the value and paid the debt of the slave or the prisoner in order to procure their freedom. Jesus came to pay that kind of ransom for us. Right? Do you know that Jesus didn't just make it possible that you might be saved if you get your act straight and do what you should. Rather, Jesus paid the full price of the debt to sin that you owed, because of sin that you owed. He has purchased your freedom. Now, how you understand the debt that you owed and what Jesus has done for you is what makes all the difference as to how it is that you understand how great your debt was or is, and what it is that you've been delivered from, and how it is that you live your life as a consequence to it. And this brings us to the call of discipleship, right? Jesus' mission is to give his life as a ransom, for a ransom. The call to discipleship. Though the disciples in the crowd accompanying Jesus, right, don't know what we know about the end of the story, they're not in a bad place. And why is that? Because they are actually following Jesus. They are in his company. They are going where he is going. He is their rabbi. He is their teacher, their master, right? They have stepped behind to follow him where he goes. And however, as Jesus speaks with James and John, he speaks of the manner of life that's going to be called out from them. It's going to be called out from them in their following Jesus as king. He says, you will drink the cup I drink and be baptized with the baptism that I am baptized with. You have to know something about James and John's stories. They were bookends of sorts as it relates to all of the apostles. James was the first of the 12 beside Judas to die. James was the first to die. And the apostle John, he was the last to die. Right? It's not the glory that they were imagining for themselves. But do you think that either of them were disappointed? Right? For one who knows the loving kindness and mercy of Jesus Christ, the call to discipleship is a glorious thing. Right? But for the one who merely knows it as information, right, the significance of Jesus paying the ransom is just something that is theoretical, it's a right answer, it's transactional, it's informational. Unless you know the love of Jesus who came to pay a ransom for you and did so by emptying, by drinking to the bottom the cup of God's wrath against injustice and sin, you won't find peace in the reality of the glory of the kingdom of God. And you're not going to find peace in the reality that that glory in the kingdom mirrors the glory that Jesus entered into and endured. Right? What Jesus explains would be unthinkable. You know that those who are regarded as rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and their high officials exercise authority over them. Not so with you. Instead, whoever wants to be great among you must be your servant. And whoever wants to be first must be the slave of all. That kind of glory, that makes absolutely no sense in the world's economy. But in understanding who Jesus is and what it is that he has done for us, it makes perfect sense. It makes something that you want to step into and to enter into. Right? If you believe that the only glory that there is or was, the only glory to be had, the only glory that's worth you spending yourself on, your life on, is only in this world, what Jesus said was it would be ridiculous. But if you know who Jesus is and what it is that you have done, what he has done for you, what he has done for those who place their faith in him, it doesn't merely make sense. It is the best offer you could ever stake your life on. One person in our passage seems to get that. What others perceive, he sees. What others hope to profit in his coming into his kingdom, he lets everything go for it. So we look at the disciple who gets it. that disciple is a blind beggar. Firstly, this blind beggar is named, right? When people are named, we should pay attention to that. His name is given by Mark as Bartimaeus, that is, son of Timaeus. The implication is that he was well known and that he was still alive. Mark and Peter are inviting you to go find him and to talk with him. It's a footnote sort of a reference. Mark's saying, if you don't believe me, go ask him. Now, mythic stories, made-up stories, they don't contain eyewitness source references. Do you get that? This is not the way in which you would tell a made-up story. It seems that Bartimaeus had not always been blind also, for he recovered his sight. And if that's the case, he may not always have been a beggar. He doesn't seem merely to be a man who knew he was missing something he imagined other people enjoyed, but he had something, and it was possibly and hopelessly lost to him because he had become blind. Everything was hopelessly lost. Not only now was he not able to provide for himself, but he was physically alienated from the world around him, from everything that he may have counted as a possession and a love. All that he could be assured that he possessed was what he, you know, all that he could be sure that he possessed was what he held in his hands. And as he cries out to Jesus, note the manner in which he cries out. There's no conditional bargaining like what James and John do when they request of Jesus. Remember what they asked him? We want you to do for us whatever we ask. You can see that coming a mile away. You know, if somebody comes to you and say, I'm going to ask you something, only I want you to give it to me regardless of what you think of it, right? Whatever it is that I'm going to say next, I want you to do that for me. If somebody comes to you with that kind of a question, we know that that's not going to be the case. Consequently, do we presume to come to Jesus asking with conditions upon which they are given? And to what extent? Having become blind, this man has learned to beg. It's been his life's necessity. How is it that one asks? They ask shamelessly. He cries out, Jesus, Son of David, have mercy on me. Now, the thing about being a blind beggar is that you have nothing to lose, even if the crowd tries to shut you up and shut you down. Their rebuke only encourages him all the more. He shouts all the louder, Jesus, Son of David, have mercy on me. Now, firstly, the crowd, it does include Jesus of Nazareth. Secondly, he's yelling loud enough to be heard. And what does he do? He cries all the more. How about you? How often have you given up in prayer, thinking that the Lord does not hear you or does not care? Right, making a point about the nature of his kingdom, Jesus doesn't answer the man directly, but he tells the others, call him. He tells the others, call him. That is, you tell this needy man that I, Jesus, want to hear from him. Friends, this is the work of sharing the good news about what Jesus has done for us. The Son of Man, the Son of David, the Christ, wants you to come to him. And we are given the privilege of letting people know that. A seminary professor of mine shared a story with us when I was in seminary, and it provides an example of the sort of calling which Jesus is calling us to. In a book, Approaching God, Steve Brown, he shares this story, and he says this. He says, not too long ago, and this story took place in the 90s, maybe probably late 80s. mid-80s maybe, just as the AIDS epidemic. Sorry, I got to walk that back. That was like, oh, it was 10 years ago or something like that, probably. I don't know. The mid-80s, right, when the AIDS epidemic was just starting, and there was just a lot of not knowing what it meant and what caused it. He says this, not too long ago, that not too long ago was, you know, not too long from 1986. I conducted a funeral for the spouse of a very dear friend of mine. The spouse died of AIDS. My friend moved in a very fast crowd, and the funeral service in the home was quite informal. There was a keyboard artist playing jazz and plenty of booze and balloons. The people who came to the service were not the kind of people who generally are found sitting in the front row of First Church by the gas station. In fact, most of the folks who were at the service had long since given up on religion. I could understand that. I've almost given up on several occasions. I went to the keyboard artist and I said to him, "Son, when you finish this piece, bring it to an end because I'm going to say some religious things." When he stopped playing and there was a silence, I decided to follow Jesus' example. He would probably, judging the report of the gospel writers who chronicled his life, be more comfortable with people like this than with the normal folks who attend normal funeral services. So after saying a quick silent prayer, I said to the folks there, "I don't do many funerals with booze and balloons, but it's okay because that's the way my friend would have wanted it. The balloons are appropriate because this is not a funeral service, it's a graduation service. Our friend isn't here. She's in another place where there isn't any more pain. She's in heaven, and I'm going to tell you why. I told the people of Jesus' love. I told them that their friend wasn't in heaven because she was a good person. They all knew better than that. But because she knew that she wasn't a good person and had turned to one who loved her enough to die on a cross in her place. I'm here," I went on, "for only one reason. You needed someone to tell you the truth. I'm just one bad person telling other bad people the most important thing that you will ever hear. God is God. And you should remember that. But if you go to him, he won't be angry with you. In fact, he'll love you." Our friend found that out, and we wanted to make sure that you knew it too. The blind beggar knew something of his own need, and he gambled everything on the mercy of Jesus. How is it that we know this? Because we read in verse 50, "And throwing off his cloak, he sprang up and came to Jesus." Now, here's the thing. What do you call a blind beggar who throws off his cloak? A blind beggar who has just lost his cloak? In responding to Jesus' call, you have to throw aside all that's keeping you from coming to him. Maybe it's all that you imagine you have to lose or let go of in order to go to him. Or maybe it's all that you think disqualifies you in going to him. Steve Brown's friend came to Jesus throwing to the side all that she felt would keep her from being received by Jesus. She was a woman with AIDS in a place, Miami, Florida, and at a time in the mid-80s when there was a great stigma associated with the disease. She found that the Lord was not angry with her, but that he had forgiven her and loved her, and it changed her funeral. Friends, I want you to hear loud and clear, whatever it is that you think is holding you back, to throw it to the side and to cheer up. He is calling you. As we receive the Lord's Supper, Jesus tells us that in receiving the supper that we're to do it in remembrance of him. To remember is to take a piece of something, right, a member, and to put it back with what it belongs to. Right, that Jesus died is not new information. That Jesus died for us is something that we forget every day. That Jesus died for and offers himself to you is something that you need to put together, not just mentally, but in your heart. He has paid the price, the full price of your ransom. He has delivered you from all of your enemies, sin, death, and the devil. That Jesus has died for us means that he is the judge, not us. No one, nobody owes a ransom slave anything. You hear that? Nobody owes a ransom slave anything, because all of the debts have been taken up by the one who paid the ransom. And so we don't hold grudges with one another. We don't harbor resentments or try to make others pay. We have given that all up. Right? Jesus, in this meal, is offering himself to us. And he is reminding us, he wants us to remember the ransom that he has paid for us, that has set us free. And consequently, he wants to speak to us of the future hope that we have, that one day we will all be gathered together and be remembered with one another. The sacrament is a sacrament for those who have made a profession of faith in Jesus, who have been baptized and received into the community of Jesus. And so if that's not you, I want to encourage you to just let the elements pass you by. I also just want to say I'd love to talk with you about anything that you had questions about. But this is a meal in which Jesus is reminding you that he has given himself for you. He has paid your ransom.